Chapter 44. The door in the cloister opened, and the Duke crossed the garden. He walked slowly, with the listless step as he had observed in him of late, and as he entered she saw that he looked pale and weary. "You have been at work again," she said.
"A cabinet meeting?"
"Yes," he answered, sinking into the abbess's high-carved chair. He glanced musingly about the dim room, in which the shadow of the cloister made an early dusk. Its atmosphere of monastic calm, of which the significance did not escape him, fell soothingly on his spirit. It simplified his relation to Fulvia by tacitly restricting it within the bounds of a tranquil tenderness. Any other setting would have seemed less in harmony with their fate. Better, perhaps, than Fulvia, he knew what ailed them both. Happiness had come to them, but it had come too late. It had come tinged with disloyalty to their early ideals. It had come when delay and disillusionment had imperceptibly weakened the springs of passion. For it is the saddest thing about sorrow, that it deadens the capacity for happiness. And to Fulvia and Odo the joy they had renounced had returned with an exile's alien face. Seeing that he remained silent, she rose and lit the shaded lamp on the table. He watched her as she moved across the room. Her step had lost none of its flowing grace, of that harmonious impetus which years ago had drawn his boyish fancy in its wake. As she bent above the lamp, the circle of light threw her face into relief against the deepening shadows of the room. As he had changed, indeed, but as those change in whom the springs of life are clear and abundant. It was a development, rather than a diminution. The old purity of outline remained, and deep below the surface, but still visible sometimes to his lessening insight, the old girlish spirit, radiant, tender and impetuous, stirred for a moment in her eyes. The lamplight fell on the pamphlets as he had pushed aside. Odo picked one up. "What are these?" he asked. "They were sent to me by the English traveler whom Andrea and I brought here." He turned a few pages. "The old story," he said. "Do you never weary of it?"
"An old story?" she exclaimed. "I thought it had been the newest in the world. Is it not being written, chapter by chapter, before our very eyes?"
Odo laid the treatise aside. "Are you never afraid to turn the next page?" he asked.
"Afraid? Afraid of what?"
"That it may be written in blood." She uttered a quick exclamation. Then her face hardened, and she said in a low tone, "Colon de Crucis has been with you." He made the half-resigned, half-impatient gesture of the man who feels himself drawn into a familiar argument from which there is no issue. "He left yesterday for Germany." "He was here too long," she said, with an uncontrollable escape of bitterness. Odo sighed. "If he would, but let me bring him to you, you would see that his influence over me is not what you think it." She was silent a moment. Then she said, "Colin, you are tired tonight. Let us not talk of these things." "As you please," he answered, with an air of relief, and she rose and went to the harpsichord. She played softly, with a veiled touch, gliding from one crepuscular melody to another, till the room was filled with drifts of sound that seemed like the voice of its own shadows. There had been times when he could have yielded himself to this languid tide of music, letting it loosen the ties of thought till he floated out into the soothing dimness of sensation. But now the present held him. To Fulvia too, he knew the music was but a forced interlude, a mechanical refuge from thought. She had deliberately narrowed their intercourse to one central idea, and it was her punishment that silence had come to be merely an intensified expression of this idea. When she turned to Odo, she saw the same consciousness in his face. It was useless for them to talk of other things. With a pang of unreasoning regret, she felt that as he had become to him the embodiment of a single thought, a formula, rather than a woman. "Tell me what you have been doing," she said. The question was a relief. At once he began to separation of his work. All his thoughts, all his time, were given to the constitution which was to define the powers of church and state. The difficulties increased as the work advanced.
But the gravest difficulty was one, of which he dared not tell her. His own growing distrust of the ideas for which he labored. He was too keenly aware of the difference in their mental operations. With Fulvia, ideas were either rejected, or at once converted into principles. With himself, they remained stored in the mind, serving rather as commentaries on life than as incentives to action. This perpetual accessibility to new impressions was a quality she could not understand, or could conceive of only as a weakness. Her own mind was like a garden in which nothing is ever transplanted. She allowed for no intermediate stages between error and dogma, for no shifting of the bounds of conviction, and this security gave her the singleness of purpose in which he found himself more and more deficient. Odo remembered that he had once thought her nearness would dispel his hesitations. At first it had been so, but gradually the contact with her fixed enthusiasms had set up within him an opposing sense of the claims ignored. The element of dogmatism in her faith showed the discouraging sameness of the human mind. He perceived that to a spirit like Fulvia's it might become possible to shed blood in the cause of tolerance. The rapid march of events in France had necessarily produced an opposite effect on minds so differently constituted. To Fulvia the year had been a year of victory, a glorious affirmation of her political creed. Step by step as he had seen, as in some old allegorical painting, error fly before the shafts of truth. Where Odo beheld a conflagration she saw a sunrise, and all that was bare and cold in her own life was warmed and transfigured by that ineffable brightness. She listened patiently while he enlarged on the difficulties of the case. The Constitution was framed in all its details, but with its completion he felt more than ever doubtful of the wisdom of granting it. He would have welcomed any postponement that did not seem an admission of fear. He dreaded the inevitable break with the clergy, not so much because of the consequent danger to his own authority, as because he was increasingly conscious of the newness and clumsiness of the instrument with which he proposed to replace their tried and complex system. He mentioned to Fulvia the rumors of popular disaffection, but she swept them aside with a smile. "The people mistrust you," she said. "And what does that mean?" "That you have given your enemies time to work on their credulity. The longer you delay, the more opposition you will encounter. Father Ignazio would rather destroy the state than let it be saved by any hand but his." Odo reflected. "Oh, of all my enemies," he said, "Father Ignazio is the one I most respect, because he is the most sincere." "He is the most dangerous, then," she returned. "A fanatic is always more powerful than a knave." He was struck with her undiminished faith in the sufficiency of such generalizations. Did she really think that to solve such a problem it was only necessary to define it? The contact with her unfaltering assurance would once have given him a momentary glow, but now it left him cold. She was speaking more urgently. "As surely," she said, "the noblest use a man can make of his own freedom is to set others free. My father said it was the only justification of kingship." He glanced at her half sadly. "Do you still fancy that kings are free? I am bound hand and foot." "So was my father," she flashed back at him, "but he had the Promethean spirit." She colored at her own quickness, but Odo took the thrust tranquilly. "Yes," he said, "your father had the Promethean spirit. I have not. The flesh that is daily torn from me does not grow again." "Your courage is as great as his," she exclaimed, her tenderness in arms. "No," he answered, "for his was hopeful." There was a pause, and then he began to speak of the day's work. All the afternoon he had been in consultation with Crescenti, whose vast historical knowledge was of service in determining many disputed points in the tenure of land. The librarian was in sympathy with any measures tending to relieve the condition of the peasantry, yet he was almost as strongly opposed as Tresker to any reproduction of the Tuscan constitution. "He is afraid," broke from Fulvia. She admired and respected Crescenti, yet as he had never fully trusted him. The taint of ecclesiasticism was on him. Odo smiled. He has never been afraid of facing the charge of Jansenism, he replied. All his life he has stood in open opposition to the church party. It is one thing to criticize their dogmas, another to attack their privileges. At such a time he is bound to remember that he is a priest, that he is one of them. Yet, as you have often pointed out, it is to the clergy that France in great measure owes her release from feudalism. She smiled coldly. If France would have won her cause without the clergy. This is not France, then, he said with a sigh. After a moment he began again, can you not see that any reform which aims at reducing the power of the clergy must be more easily and successfully carried out if they can be induced to take part in it? That, in short, we need them at this moment as we have never needed them before? The example of France ought at least to show you that. The example of France shows me that, to gain a point in such a struggle, any means must be used. In France, as you say, the clergy were with the people, here they are against them. Where persuasion fails, coercion must be used. Odo smiled faintly. Why, you might have borrowed that from their own armory, he said. She colored at the sarcasm. Why not? She retorted. Let them have a taste of their own methods. They know the kind of pressure that makes men yield when they feel it, they will know what to do. He looked at her with astonishment. This is Gamba's tone, he said. I have never heard you speak in this way before. She colored again, and now with a profound emotion. Why, yes, she said, it is Gamba's tone. He and I speak for the same cause, and with the same voice. We are of the people and we speak for the people. Who are your other counselors? Priests and noblemen. It is natural enough that they should wish to make their side of the question heard. Listen to them, if you will conciliate them, if you can. We need all the allies we can win. Only do not fancy they are really speaking for the people. Do not think it is the people's voice you hear. The people do not ask you to weigh this claim against that, to look too curiously into the defects and merits of every clause in their charter. All they ask is that the charter should be given them. She spoke with the low-voiced passion that possessed her at such moments. All acrimony had vanished from her tone. The expression of a great conviction had swept aside every personal animosity and cleared the sources of her deepest feeling. Odo felt the pressure of her emotion. He leaned to her, and their hands met. It shall be given them, he said. She lifted her face to his. It shone with a great light. Once before he had seen it so illumined, but with how different a brightness. The remembrance stirred in him some old habit of the senses. He bent over and kissed her. 4.7. Never before had Odo so keenly felt the difference between theoretical visions of liberty and their practical application. His deepest heart searchings showed him as sincerely devoted as ever to the cause which had enlisted his youth. He still longed above all things to serve his fellows, but the conditions of such service were not what he had dreamed. How different a calling it had been in St. Francis's day, when hearts inflamed with the new sense of brotherhood had but to set forth on their simple mission of almsgiving and admonition. To love one's neighbor had become a much more complex business, one that taxed the intelligence as much as the heart, and in the course of which feeling must be held in firm subjection to reason. He was discouraged by Fulvia's inability to understand the change. Hers was the missionary spirit, and he could not but reflect how much happier she would have been as a nun in a charitable order, a unit in some organized system of beneficence. He too would have been happier to serve than to command. But it is not given to the lovers of the Lady Poverty to choose their special rank in her household. Don Gervaso's words came back to him with deepening significance, and he thought how truly the old chaplain's prayer had been fulfilled. Honor and power had come to him, and they had abased him to the dust. The humilitas of his fathers, woven, carved, and painted on every side, pursued him with an ironical reminder of his impotence. Fulvia had not been mistaken in attributing his depression of spirit to De Crucis's visit. It was the first time that De Crucis had returned to Pianura since the new duke's accession. Odo had welcomed him eagerly, had again pressed him to remain, but De Crucis was on his way to Germany, bound on some business which could not be deferred. Odo, aware of the renewed activity of the Jesuits, supposed that this business was connected with the flight of the French refugees, many of whom were gone to Koblenz, but on this point the abate was silent. Of the state of affairs in France he spoke openly and despondently. The immoderate haste with which the reforms had been granted filled him with fears for the future. Odo knew that Crescent I shared these fears, and the judgment of these two men, with whom he differed on fundamental principles, weighed with him far more than the opinions of the party he was supposed to represent. But he was in the case of many greater sovereigns of his day. He had set free the waters of reform, and the frail bark of his authority had been torn from its moorings and swept headlong into the central current. The next morning, to his surprise, the Duchess sent one of her gentlemen to ask an audience. Odo at once replied that he would wait on Her Highness, and a few moments later he was ushered into his wife's closet. As he had just left her toilet, and was still in the morning negligee worn during that prolonged and public ceremonial. Freshly perfumed and powdered, her eyes bright, her lips set in a nervous smile, she curiously recalled the arrogant child who had snatched her spaniel away from him years ago in that same room. And was she not that child, after all? Had she ever grown beyond the imperious instincts of her youth? It. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.